4:55 on Friday, November 20th. Good. Okay. So I got an email from one of the students in the class saying maybe it would be better to have the exam on Friday after break. What do people think about that? Would that improve things over having it on Wednesday? Anybody have strong objections to moving it to Friday? It's fine with me. So let's do it. We'll move it to Friday. I think may give me the opportunity to throw in a question about security or something. No? Yeah, well, that's what's going to be fresh on our minds, though, by then. Okay, speaking of security, there is a security class next semester that you might be interested in, or maybe I'll manage to turn you completely off to it so you won't be interested in it at all, but usually not. It's a pretty interesting subject. It'll be 9:30 in the morning, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It's taught by a University of Idaho professor, and will probably be available on television here at WSU. I think that's the intention. If not, you'll have to trek to Idaho for it. But you're welcome to enroll in it. Jim Elvis Foss, I think so. I've interacted with him. I haven't ever taken a class from him, but he seems enthusiastic about stuff, so that's the first criterion that I usually look for. So anyway, so Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9:30. I don't think it conflicts with anything that seniors are likely to take here, but hopefully. Okay, so we are now going to do a very whirlwind chapter on security. We've kind of been whirlwinding through networks right and left because it's a introductory course. But so, network security. The idea here in this chapter is to sort of give you an overview of the topics and terminology, some of the fundamental algorithms that are involved in security, and some of the techniques like firewalls and the like that are not sort of algorithmically based, but rather system design based. So we'll talk about all those things, although most of it is based in cryptography. So we've all heard about cryptography, you know, writing in codes, writing and decoding. But cryptography has cryptographic algorithms have techniques, have uses that go beyond the secrecy that you might initially think of when you think of cryptography. So we're going to be talking about all of those ideas, both the idea of secrecy, but also authentication and integrity. And then after we get through that, we'll talk about the firewalls and IDSs and stuff like that. So what is network security? Well, this is not what network security is. This is only a subset of what is network security. Confidentiality. There's a classic set of properties that go by the name CIA. Confidentiality, integrity, and availability, usually, is what the A is pointed to. So confidentiality is the idea that only the sender and the intended receiver should be able to understand messages that are sent in the network. And we use cryptography for that, encryption and decryption. Integrity is the idea that when a sender sends a message, the receiver should get the message that the sender sent. Okay? And be able to ensure itself that it did. And again, cryptographic techniques crop up in there. Availability is the idea that you don't want to let people be able to get into your service and do denial of service attacks. That's the main thing. That's not cryptography based. That's more where we get into the idea of firewalls and intrusion detection and stuff like that. Authentication can be looked at as a auxiliary service to confidentiality and integrity, and that has to do with the idea that how does the recipient know that the message came from the sender that it thought it came from? Okay? And how does the sender know that it's sending a message to a receiver that it knows? So all of those are sort of classical aspects of network security. So the other classical aspects of network security are that the good guys are Bob and Alice, and the bad guy is Trudy. All right, and that seems to be always the way it is. And I don't know where that came from. I didn't write that. Pardon?
There's a Wikipedia page on the history of Alice
and Bob. Alice and Bob. I haven't looked at it. Do you want to? Don't remember it. Okay, so there is a Wikipedia. So it probably because it's A, B, and sometimes there's a C person who is. I don't remember. Anyway, okay. So the idea is that Alice and Bob want to send messages to each other securely, and Trudy wants to break in, either to read the messages or to induce Bob or Alice to think something other than what the other said. So, in real life, they can be people, Bob and Alice can be people, but they can also be applications running on computers. So web browsers, web servers, routers, we'll talk about uses of this stuff in routing, DNS servers. Okay, so the problem actually in computer networking is that networking protocols and the internet all got started before security was much of a consideration. It was started by people who wanted to talk to their friends, and their friends were the only ones who had network connections. The Stanford AI lab and the MIT AI lab and BBN, you know, a half a dozen folks, they were the only ones in the world with network connections, and they set up the internet. The big problem is that we haven't built a notion of security into the internet from the ground up, and we're sort of in the process of fixing things and suffering from that fact. So, in talking about network security or any kind of security, for that matter, it's very important to consider what it is you think that the attackers might be trying to do to you, and provide defenses against those things. Of course, the problem is that if you're not sufficiently imaginative about what they might be trying to do to you, they might think up something that you didn't and attack you in some way that you didn't provide a defense against. So, but there's a classical set that you should be considering. Eavesdropping is the idea that somebody just wants to read the messages. Why would they want to do that? Steal credit card numbers, steal social security numbers, steal money, who knows. So that's eavesdropping. Insertion is the idea that somebody wants to sort of fool you into doing something by sending you messages that are not correct. There's a classical movie from the 1950s about, I think it's called The Man Who Never Was. Have you ever seen that? About how the
how the Allies, as D-Day was approaching, basically deposited a body in a place where the Germans were likely to find it, and it had wrong information about what the attack was going to be. So it was a matter of fooling somebody by sending them a wrong message. Impersonation, you know, when somebody wants to pretend they're somebody else, it's one kind of insertion, I guess, but it has to do with authentication as well. Hijacking is somebody's already established a connection and you manage to take it over. Now with TCP, you can sort of see how this might happen, right? If somebody's got a flow of packets going back and forth and somehow you can get in there and see that, you can masquerade as having particular IP address. If you can sync up with the sequence numbers, you could just take over and go on as if the other person were still there, and they're not. And denial of service is really of a quite different nature from the rest, because remember, any system has a finite amount of resources, and if you can come up with a way to consume those resources, the legitimate users of the resources won't be able to have them, okay? And that's, I think, really quite different from the rest of these. So that's some of the threats. So, to address those threats, we have a number of tools, and cryptography is one of the fundamental ones, although cryptography itself is not the answer to security. Cryptography is a tool that's used in security, but it's not the answer to security, and we'll see why as we go. So, some terminology about cryptography. The message that we want to send is called plain text. The result of passing the plain text through an encryption algorithm is called the ciphertext. The exact way that the encryption algorithm behaves is determined by a so-called encryption key, which is just a string of bits, usually. The ciphertext reaches the recipient, who runs a decryption algorithm on it, providing a decryption key, another string of bits, maybe the same string of bits, or maybe a different string of bits. And the result is that the recipient can then see the plain text again. Okay? So that's the key things here are plain text, ciphertext, everything on here is key thing. Plain text, yeah, okay, all those are good words to understand what they mean. When we write cryptography, write about cryptography, we often use a kind of mathematical notation that says, in which M is the plain text message, and we write the key as if it were a function, right? So the application of Alice's key to M produces the ciphertext. And in this notation, the encryption algorithm is implicit. Which algorithm we're using is implicit. There are many algorithms. But usually we settle on an encryption algorithm and then discuss the messages in the form of just the application of the key as a function. If variability of the algorithm is important, we have other notation that incorporates the algorithm itself into this notation. Okay, so then the message is retrieved by applying Bob's key to the result of applying Alice's key to the message. Okay, so how many people have played in their youth with encryption? Secret D decoder rings on cereal boxes, yeah. And yeah, that stuff. Okay. So lots of different kinds of encryption schemes exist and have over the centuries. This is actually a slightly more sophisticated one than some of the early ones. You may have heard of the Caesar cipher, right? In which you write down the normal alphabet, and you write down the normal alphabet but shifted and wrapped around, and then map the letters vertically one to another. This one is more general than that, in that we've permuted the alphabet as well. And to encipher, the encipher algorithm then is to look at a letter here and pick the corresponding letter. It's pretty obvious, okay? You can do that, of course, with bytes instead of letters. So then it's 256 to 256. If you took 355 from me, you got to do a little program where you tried to figure out one of these. Okay. So you can think of all kinds of different things. This thing was called a monoalphabetic cipher. There was one plain text alphabet, one ciphertext alphabet. You can think of having multiple ciphertext alphabets, different permutations of the letters, and then cycling through them. So you encrypt the first letter with the first cipher, the second letter with the second cipher, and so on and so forth, so that the same letter doesn't always map to the same ciphertext letter. So in each algorithm, we're going to sort of want to specify carefully what the key is. In the previous one, it was the permutation of the ciphertext alphabet letters. Here, it's the set of ciphertext alphabets together with the pattern through which you cycle. And you wouldn't have to, you wouldn't have to cycle through the pattern always the same way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. You could go 1, 3, 4, 2, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, and do all the different permutations in a different order. Okay, so it's a little bit more complicated, but not a great cipher by modern standards. Okay, so cryptology is the science of ciphers, and it includes both the making of ciphers and the breaking of ciphers. And there's some terminology associated with cipher breaking. Remember, we said we had to specify what the attacker was capable of doing, right? And when we're talking about cipher schemes, cryptography schemes, we can think about attackers who have different powers. So your basic attacker that you might think of is the attacker sees the encrypted message and wants to try to figure out what it says. Right? So that's called a ciphertext-only attack. Right? That's all the attacker has. But depending on the overall design of the system in which the ciphertext is in which the cryptology is embedded, you have to be careful that you don't give the attacker more powers than that. Okay? Inadvertently, or maybe you just accept them and say, I have to make cryptography good enough to handle these two other cases. It may be possible for the attacker to match up some ciphertext with some plain text. Okay? Well, this is This is more information than just having the ciphertext. And it turns out to be very useful information. There was a Nova show on PBS, and I think the library has the disc of this, about how the Enigma ciphers of World War II were broken. And it was largely based on known plain text techniques, because they always sent the same thing at the beginning of a message, like the date, in the same place in the message, or at least in close proximity, the Allied cryptographers were able to get little snatches of known plain text together with ciphertext. And that proved enough, so over the long period of the war, to actually break the codes overall. So it's a fascinating story that you may want to take a look at. I think it's called Enigma. I think it's just called Enigma is the name. But it was a PBS show a while back. I can get that for you if you're interested. That's known plain text. And then even more powerful, the attacker may be able to fool, and this is again a systems issue, not a cryptography issue, the attacker may be able to fool the participants in the conversation into encrypting something that the attacker wants to have encrypted. Okay? So in that case, that's even more powerful because the attacker gets to see the ciphertext corresponding to something that they chose. And depending on, again, on the structure of the cipher, of the cryptography algorithms, that may tell them something useful. Okay? So that's the structure of that. So modern cryptography is almost entirely computer-based, and the thing you have to keep in mind is that not only is the cryptography done with computers, but so is the cryptanalysis. The attempts to break the codes. And so algorithms that people can do with pencil and paper are almost, I would say, probably universally easily broken by computers. So there just isn't any hope of doing anything with pencil and paper anymore that a computer could not break. Although there is one thing. There's one technique, is I know it's not mentioned in these slides. So the one technique that is always secure is, and it's not mentioned here, but it's a pain in the neck, is the so-called one-time pad. I just have a string of numbers. And I have, this is the pad, and the message, whatever it is, A, B, C, D, E. Add those up modulo, say the size of a byte, and you get an encrypted message. If the sender and the receiver share a one-time pad, and they never reuse anything in the pad, then this is an absolutely secure method of communication. Because the only way to figure it out is to know what that pad says. And if you don't know what the pad says, then you can make up a pad to make this message say anything you want it to say. Okay? It's the easiest way to see this. So, that you can do with pencil and paper. It's a pain in the neck, because you have to have the one-time pads at both the sender and the receiver. Okay? And you use them up as you go. And depending on the situation you're in, mere possession of such a thing is probably grounds to get you shot. Not in the modern world. Not in the United States, but in certain situations where you might want this to be happening, that would be a bad thing. Okay, so they're pain in the neck. So The assumption that we almost always make in talking about cryptography is that the algorithm is known to everyone. And this is to rule out something called security by obscurity. Which is repeatedly shown to be ineffective. Okay, so the best practice says no, you don't try to keep secrets except for the keys. The keys are the secrets. The algorithm is known. Okay? Beginning in the late 1970s. We have a set of cryptographic techniques called public key cryptography, a completely new mathematical invention made around 1976 or 1977. Nobody had a clue that this could be done or even was a good thing to do before that point in time. Before that, the world has used what's called symmetric key cryptography. Uses only one key that's shared between the sender and the receiver. Okay, and then we're going to talk about hash functions, which are strictly speaking not cryptography at all, but they're useful auxiliaries to cryptography by letting us do less work to do certain operations. Okay, so we're going to talk about some different instances of this in these kinds of cryptography. So this is classical cryptography. There's a single key, single symmetric key, that Bob and Alice share. The problem that this poses is that you actually have to be sure that you, Bob, and you, Alice, have to be sure that the other is the only one who has this key. That's one problem you have. And the other problem is, how do you get the keys in the first place? Okay? But if you can solve those problems, then this is the classical way of doing cryptography. There's a small change here. I would like to write KS inverse there instead of KS. It's really an inversion of the function, right? If KS is a function of M, then KS inverse is the thing that undoes KS. But the point is that you can find the inverse from the symmetric key. Okay. So there are two different kinds of symmetric ciphers that people use. So-called stream ciphers have the property that you can give them one more bit and they can give you the next bit of the output. The block ciphers require that you break the message up into multi-bit blocks and have to have the entire block before you can produce the next bit of output. Even with block ciphers, you can encrypt a message of any length by deciding on rules for padding, right? If the message ends at a certain point and you don't have enough bits to form the last block, provide some zeros for padding or anything else you want to agree on as recognizable padding. So the idea of the stream cipher is that you feed the key into some algorithm that generates what's called a key stream, just a sequence of bits. And the idea is that you XOR the bits of the key stream with the bits of the message to produce the bits of the ciphertext. Okay? And if you think about it, XOR is a symmetric function. So in this case, the inverse key is exactly the same as the forward key, right? Just reproduce the same key stream and XOR it into the bits, and it will remove the effect of what you did before, and you're left with what you started with. Okay. This is essentially the same story as the one-time pad, except that in the one-time pad case, you provide the key stream directly. The key stream is the key. Okay, particular ciphers here in this format, the RC4, you'll hear this name RC4. What makes a stream cipher a good cipher? What makes any cipher a good cipher? Nobody really knows. This is the problem. Okay, the best that we have available to us is extensive analysis. You put a lot of mathematicians to work looking for the known and unknown mathematical weaknesses of an algorithm, trying to figure out if there's some way that you can extract the plain text messages from the ciphertext without trying all of the possible keys. Now, so RC4 is the algorithm. The key is a sequence of bits up to 256 bytes long. Think about how many trillions of centuries it might take you to try all of the possible keys that are 256 bytes long. Okay? If that's the only way to break the cipher. We're going to talk about wireless security and wireless networks as we get toward the end here. WEP stands for Wired Equivalent Privacy. It was one of the early security schemes for wireless Ethernet. It's broken. Doesn't work, insecure, not because of a brokenness in the encryption algorithm, but because of a brokenness in the way that it's used in the system. Okay, so this is something that I want to stress. So you can have an excellent cryptography, and you can design it into a system in such a way that it's easily broken, and that's what happened with WEP. Okay, so that was stream ciphers. The other form is the block cipher. You break it up into blocks of a fixed size and then map that block onto an equal sized block of ciphertext. And you can think of this as happening with table lookup, but it is pretty impractical to implement as table lookup. Instead, it's implemented as sort of I can make up a word and call it confusicating algorithms, but that's not a real word. But there is a real word that means that. Anybody know what it is? I don't know. Anyway, okay. So table lookup, you know, you have this and you look, produce the output. Obvious to see how that works. Even for 3 bits, there are 40,000 different tables that could exist, mapping 3 bits to 3 bits. So if you have 64 bits, that's a huge number of possible keys, right, that you would have to try. But the table is too huge. So we'll use a function that does something like this. Break up the input into reasonable size chunks. Do a table lookup on each of the chunks, producing a chunk of the same size. Okay? These S boxes are different. So each of these, depending on its position, each of these 8-bit chunks goes through a different mapping. Put them back together, scramble them up, and feed it back into the input, and do that several times. Okay? This is the structure of the DES algorithm, and I think also the AES algorithm works this way as well. So the algorithm here is fixed. The mappings of the mappings done in each of these steps is known. The scrambling is known. So how do we provide a key to this? Well, we start out by loading it up with... Oh, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Why rounds? Because there's an interesting property here. If you look at any single bit here in the input, it affects 8 bits here, right? 1 bit here can only belong to one of these 8-bit mappings. So 1 bit here affects 8 bits here. We scramble it up, not 8-bit by 8-bit, but bit by bit. And so these 8 bits here potentially get scattered over 8 different bytes here. And then I feed that back. And now those 8 bits can affect 64 bits in the second pass through here. Okay, I scramble those up, feed it back through here again, and so on and so forth. So you could arrange that every bit potentially affects every other bit as you go through the multiple rounds. So multiple rounds is good. I don't like that terminology. Becomes more, if you do multiple rounds, it takes you longer to do it. More time consuming. I can explain to you why I don't like efficient as a word for that, but not right now. Okay, so how do you use this thing in practice? Well, you don't want to just break up the message into 64-bit chunks and encrypt each one of them separately, because that would give you the same output when you gave it the same input. Okay? And that gives somebody else the opportunity to inject meaningful stuff into messages. Right? If they want to inject something, particular message, they can just inject something they've seen before and get this same thing to happen. So we could use it like a one-time pad thing where we generate a key for each different plain text. And that would work, but again, it would take a lot of time, and you'd have to send twice the data. Okay, so instead, what we'll do is we'll actually take the output of the previous stage and feed it back into the next stage, and that's called cipher block chaining. And you can sort of do an arbitrary initialization of CBC, right, for each message or session or whatever, so that you never ever have to send something that will repeat the ciphertext, except perhaps accidentally. And that's helpful in giving the potential attacker as little to stand on as possible. It's not clear to me that this is always necessary to prevent attacks, but it's considered good practice and it's easy to do, so people say do it, right? There's sort of no downside to this approach. Okay, so that just explains that again. So DES is the U.S. encryption standard that was in effect from the late 1970s until the mid 1990s. It uses a 56-bit key and 64-bit blocks. It defines how to do cipher block chaining. So part of the idea is, right, you can encrypt stuff, but if nobody can read it, it's not very useful. So having standards is what lets us do different implementations of the algorithms means that I can encrypt something that you can read with perhaps a different implementation of the algorithm. So you know, you have to say, not only does how that shuffling process works, but also very in great detail how the cipher block chaining works, and so on and so forth. There's just a lot of details there that have to be specified, and that's why we have a standard. So, unfortunately, it turns out that with 56-bit keys, remember, DES doesn't have the full space of possible results that a table-driven algorithm would have. And it has enough structure that people are able to sort of do a brute force attack in less than a day with computers of current age. So to fix that, and because DES is so widely implemented that it's a sort of system-level problem to replace it, people came up with the idea of using DES three times, with three different keys on the same message. Okay? And at the time DES was invented, this would have been too slow. Today, it's still slower than some competing methods, but it's fast enough that you can get useful work done with it. Right? And 3DES is considered still secure because it has 168 bits of key. Okay, so it basically has the structure of what we saw before. The key here actually affects the behavior of the table lookups that go on. So we get 64 bits in and 64 bits out. The key different parts of the key are used at each stage, and there are 17. Is that right? 17 stages. Okay. You know, you got to have a warped mind to work on this stuff. I think. But some people find it fun. Okay. So DES was seen to be coming to the end of its life, the National Institute of Standards and Technology is the government organization that's responsible for this stuff, solicited proposals for replacement standards from companies like IBM and RSA and the like, and they came up with this new algorithm called AES, Advanced Encryption Standard, uses 128-bit blocks and now can go up to as much as 256-bit keys. And that's seen as being sufficient for the next couple of decades anyway. Okay, that's a great place to stop because the next topic is public key cryptography, which works not at all like this at all. Not at all like this. Okay, so completely different set of techniques. Have a great break, and we'll have the exam on Friday, December 4th.